Our next case this morning is Kroll against Sunderman.
May it please the court.
If you want, you can raise the height of that podium a little. Raise the height of the whole podium. There's a little switch in the right.
How about that, huh? Miracles of modern science.
Great. Thank you very much. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bart Wagner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the defendant's appellants on this appeal from the District Court's denial of the defendant's motion for summary judgment on qualified immunity grounds. In analyzing the qualified immunity claim, this court must undertake a two-part test. First, the court must determine whether there was a constitutional violation. If the court determines that there was, the court must determine whether the plaintiff's rights were clearly established at the time of the violation. The defendants were entitled to summary judgment on both parts because they prevail on both parts of this test. To begin with, there is no constitutional violation in this case. The plaintiffs claim...
Well, I have some doubts about whether we have appellate jurisdiction here. I can't see your argument as one about legal uncertainty. There's no uncertainty about the due process clause here. Ever since Perry against Sinderman, Roth against the Board of Regents in 1972, it's been clear what the legal rules are. The legal rules have been absolutely pellucid for 31 years. The only question that seems to be on the table is the meaning of Illinois law, because it's state law, not federal law, that creates property interests. But why should we allow what seems to be entirely a state law question be brought up on an interlocutory appeal?
Well, I believe there are a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. First, I don't think that this is an entirely state law question. The question is whether there's a protected interest under...
That's the holding of Roth. Whether there is an underlying protected interest is a question of state and not federal law. And it's that issue that you're seeking to argue. It's an issue of state law.
You're definitely correct, Your Honor, that whether there's a property right here is a matter of state law. It does depend on some sort of independent source that comes from state law. That's true. But the question is whether there's a federally protected constitutional right as a result of a state law providing a protected interest.
Let me try again. State law defines property interests.
Correct.
Federal law defines the consequences of having property interests. This appeal is not about the consequences of having property interests. The appeal is about whether, as a matter of state law, a property interest has been defined. And the question I'm posing to you is why that should be subject to an interlocutory appeal.
Because the state law question leads to the federal suit to which the defendants claim qualified immunity. And the Supreme Court has recognized the importance of determining the qualified immunity question at the outset of the litigation. The court has reiterated the fact that the qualified immunity, according to the defendants, is only from the lawsuit. That's why when that defense is raised, it's important to determine whether it's applicable, whether there was a constitutional violation. It is true to determine whether there was a constitutional violation here. You must determine whether there was a right provided by state law. But once that question is answered, the next step has to be taken, determine whether there's a violation of the federal constitutional right and whether that was clearly established. Otherwise, the defense is eviscerated, and if an appeal is not permitted at this point, then the defense would not receive the immunity from the lawsuit, would have to stand for the suit, which is contrary to the purpose, the principle of the qualified immunity defense, Your Honor. The basis of the plaintiff's constitutional claim is that her right to due process was violated because she was discharged from her position with the Judicial Inquiry Board without notice of the charges or with a hearing. Because the plaintiff was only an at-will employee, however, she did not have a property right that was protected by the federal Constitution. Therefore, she could not state a claim for deprivation of her right to due process. She attempts to locate her property right in the statutes of the state of Illinois, specifically the Personnel Code. The Illinois Personnel Code provides for a system of personnel administration under the governor of the state of Illinois. That statute has no application to the Judicial Inquiry Board or its employees. To begin with, the Illinois Constitution under Article 6, Section 15D specifically gives the board the power to appoint and direct its employees. In other words, the Illinois Constitution provides this constitutionally created agency as part of the judiciary the power to administer, to affect its own personnel administration. The Personnel Code cannot infringe on that right. Related to this is the separation of powers that is part of the Illinois state constitutional design. That doctrine holds that a different branch of government, the executive or the legislative in this case, cannot exercise a power that has been specifically provided to the judiciary. The board, as part of the judiciary, has been given the power to appoint and direct its employees. The Personnel Code cannot, the branches of government, through the application of the Personnel Code, cannot intrude upon that right. Additionally, putting these constitutional considerations aside for a moment, interpreting the statute yields the same result. Under Illinois statutory construction principles, the interpretation of a statute given by the agency that is empowered to enforce and administer the statute is entitled to significant deference. In this case, the Department of Central Management Services, the agency that administers the Personnel Code, has held that the Personnel Code does not apply to the Judicial Inquiry Board for the entire 33 years, that the Judicial Inquiry Board has existed. Additionally, the plaintiff attempts to locate a property right and the fact that there's a mutually explicit understanding between her and the board that she was something other than an at-will employee, that she had a right to permanent employment with the agency. However, the record shows no facts indicating any sort of mutually explicit understanding that the Personnel Code applied to Kroll. Instead, the record shows that Kroll received a policy of daily operations distributed by the department that stated explicitly that employees are not governed by the Personnel Code. Additionally, the board adopted as its policy in 1993 a 1993 Illinois Attorney General opinion letter that stated that the Judicial Inquiry Board was not subject to the rules of the Personnel Code. Furthermore, there are no facts showing a mutually explicit understanding between the board and Kroll that she was not an at-will employee without reference to the Personnel Code. The record shows that, in fact, that the board considered Kroll, the plaintiff, to be an at-will employee. Defendant Sonderman, board member Sonderman, specifically told her that she was an at-will employee a few months before she was terminated. This produced no evidence, no facts to suggest that the board considered her anything other than at will. The evidence that she does provide rests on the statements by a former executive director of the Judicial Inquiry Board, to the extent that Kroll could only be fired for cause. However, there are no facts showing that the executive director had the power or the authority to bind the board with those statements. That the executive director was...
I think, counsel, that you're digging, at least as I see it, a deeper hole on jurisdiction. Every time you say there are no facts showing that X, you run into problems, actual or potential, under Johnson against Jones, which holds that there's no appellate jurisdiction to review the sufficiency of facts on an interlocutory immunity appeal. The only question that we can review is our legal questions.
I understand, Your Honor. My point is that all the facts that are here are undisputed, and the application of the undisputed facts to determine whether there is the qualified immunity defense is a question of law and is properly before this court. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
1 minute.
Well, I'm telling you to my rebuttal time, so thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lignan. Ms. Caparuso. you want. You can
switch
down.
I think I need to
do
that, don't I? Goes in both directions, doesn't it?
Yep.
Do it again.
Otherwise, we'd be doomed.
It's not as visible as the one in the Supreme Court, where it's a hand crank.
Mm-hmm.
Each advocate gets up and starts cranking madly.
That's terrible.
And just think, Judge Easterbrook had to crank and crank and crank to get it so he could get it to the point where down.
I sometimes argued back to back with Robert Reich.
Yeah. Oh, that would involve a lot of cranking. I may please the court. My name is Catherine Caparuso. I represent the plaintiff in this case. And I agree with Judge Easterbrook that there is a very serious issue as to the jurisdiction of this court to hear this interlocutory appeal. There is a significant issue because, as this court stated recently in West versus Schwebke this year, an interlocutory appeal may not be used to present factual issues for pretrial appellate resolution. And it is incorrect that the facts presented as to the authority of the executive director are undisputed. This issue was not raised to the district court. The Judicial Inquiry Board and the defendants in this case did not argue that she did not have the authority to bind the board with their statements. That is a new argument that hasn't been made on appeal. It has been waived. And the additional issue, in addition to it being waived, is that the plaintiff disputes this new assertion, this new factual assertion that has been made by the defendant that she did not have the authority to bind the board. And in that situation, this court resolving those factual issues would be inappropriate. Even based on a limited record, defendant does not deny that the executive director that the Judicial Inquiry Board knew that the executive director was making statements to investigators to the effect that they would only be fired for a reason and after being given an opportunity to improve their performance. The defendants in this case have not denied that they knew that employees were being placed on probation for the first 6 months of their employment. They have not denied that the board knew that employees were being placed on probation again when they had performance issues and were given an opportunity to improve their performance. It has been admitted that the Judicial Inquiry Board placed the executive director herself on probation. We have, on this limited record, presented a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the executive director had the actual or the apparent authority to bind the board with their statement. In addition, the plaintiff is not relying solely on the statement by the executive director. We are also relying on the practices that the board followed with other Judicial Inquiry Board investigators. Under the defendant's theory of the case, even when the executive director of a state agency, with a full knowledge and...
Wait, hold on. That last statement.
Sure.
Is it, you mean the board has never fired an investigator before?
They have fired one investigator and essentially forced another investigator to resign. In both those circumstances, they placed that employee on probation and gave them an opportunity to improve their performance. And that is a practice that is part of the overall circumstances surrounding this termination that we say led to a reasonable expectation of continued employment on the part of the plaintiff. What the defendant is saying is that even when the executive director of a state agency with the full knowledge of the board of directors tells employees that they can only be fired for a reason and after being given an opportunity to improve their performance, and even when this statement has actually been followed in practice by the Judicial Inquiry Board, that the state can escape the requirements of the Due Process Clause simply by, at a time when they are considering terminating an employee, telling her that she's at will.
Does the record contain instances where the board did act in that way, putting people on probation?
Yes, and those are undisputed. And they are undisputed for purposes. They were undisputed at the district court level, and they are undisputed for purposes of this appeal.
But they're in the record.
They are in the record. Yes, they are. They are also seem to be claiming, and this cannot be the law.
In Illinois, I don't know how. There are many jurisdictions where doctrine of apparent authority in governmental law is indeed very weak. You look to the statutes and regulations to determine the, and occasionally the Constitution to determine the authority of a government actor, not to apparent authority. What is the law in Illinois with respect to that? Can a public board vest one of its servants with apparent authority?
Again, this is not an issue that was raised at the district court level.
That's an issue of law we need to know to decide the case. What's your view of the law?
My view of the law is under these circumstances, and I cannot provide a specific doctrine for you, but that she was acting with the knowledge of the board of directors and that therefore she had apparent authority.
And if this was the Ajax Corporation, that would probably be a good statement of the law, but I'm wondering if that's a good statement of the law when you're dealing with an independent governmental body like this.
I can't provide you any specific case law on that. I'd be certainly willing
fairly
to provide
it. Fairly dangerous doctrine, isn't it? If people could say, well, so-and-so bureaucrat told me, and then I followed that, and I never checked the laws and regulations myself.
Well, we are not arguing that is not the sole basis for the argument. What is more important, I believe, and is that they followed the practice that was stated by the executive director. The practice that was followed was consistent with the statement that was made.
So you're not relying on apparent authority, but on the fact that the board itself had an understanding that this is the way it did business.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I'd be happy to submit a post-argument memorandum on the issue of apparent authority under Illinois law.
I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We will give the parties 10 days, both sides simultaneous.
Okay. The defendants now claim during their affidavits and in their depositions that they always understood her to be an at-will employee. But that simply cannot be the way that you escape the requirements of the Due Process Clause based on everything that happened before the time that they decided to terminate her. It is undisputed that she was not told that she was an at-will employee until shortly before she was fired and when they were considering terminating her. It is also undisputed that the plaintiff was told that in the absence of a judicial inquiry board policy on a particular issue, the judicial inquiry board would look to the personnel code. By saying that, I don't mean to say that we are basing our argument that there was a mutually explicit understanding that the personnel code applied to the judicial inquiry board. What I'm saying the mutually explicit understanding was is that she would have the opportunity to improve her performance and only before being terminated and only be terminated for cause, which was the situation that took place with the other two investigators that were in this situation. The defendants now claim that they never meant to create a legitimate expectation of continued employment, but their own subjective beliefs are irrelevant. What's relevant are the promises that were made to the plaintiff and the employment practices that the board followed. They cannot avoid liability now simply by saying that they didn't mean what they said, or they didn't mean to be saying that. What Perry versus Snyderman said was that a due process claim can be founded on an unwritten common law of the workplace, and that is what we are establishing here. It is also significant that the other judicial inquiry board investigator that was working at the same time as the plaintiff also believed that he was not an at-will employee. As to the issue of the personnel code, as we stated in our brief, the personnel code applies to all agencies in the state of Illinois unless they are specifically exempted. It does not apply only to agencies that are under the governor. The defendants now claim that there is a separation of powers issue that prohibits the application of the personnel code to the judicial inquiry board. The doctrine of separation of powers means that one branch of the government assumes the power of another branch. Applying the personnel code to the way that the judicial inquiry board hires its employees is not assuming judicial power under the Constitution. If the legislature can apply the personnel code to the governor without violating the separation of powers, why cannot it, regardless of whether the judicial inquiry board is technically part of the judicial branch or not, why can it not apply the personnel code in this situation? As to the issue of qualified immunity, the question here is whether, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, whether it would be clear to reasonable officials in the defendant's position that it would be a violation of constitutional rights to fire an employee without process, even though she had been told she could be fired for cause, and after being given opportunity to improve her performance, and even though the agency had followed this practice with other employees. Whether a reasonable official in a defendant's position would believe that he or she could erase a constitutional violation simply by informing the employee that she was at will shortly before terminating her. And whether a reasonable official in the defendant's position would believe that he or she could fire an employee in this situation without even considering the promises that had been made to the employee and the practices that the board followed, or consulting the Attorney General's office for advice, which they did not do in this case.
What type of relief is your client looking for?
Our client is looking for back pay primarily and associated damages, and obviously a hearing to determine whether or not she was appropriately terminated.
And reinstatement.
And reinstatement in that situation, yes. Earlier this year, the court stated that the defense of qualified immunity is not available to the plainly incompetent. And I submit to you that the defendants in this case were plainly incompetent, and therefore they are not entitled to qualified immunity.
Thank you, Ms. Caparuso. Anything further, Mr. Wagner? You'll certainly want to use that switch now.
A couple quick points, Your Honor. First, there are no genuine issues of material fact here. The facts are undisputed. There was no mutually explicit understanding between the board and the plaintiff that she was anything other than an at-will employee.
So you do admit that the board, on occasion, has used probation.
I admit that the board has used. Yes, sir. I admit that the board has used probation for various different reasons. She has no due process right to probation. That's not the claim here, but the board has used probation for various reasons. But in fact, show that the board knew that the executive director or gave the executive director authority to make the statement that she was anything other than an at-will employee.
Well, the question is whether the board, as a matter of practice, as your colleague said, whether there was an unwritten common law of the workplace.
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
Inaugurated, maintained, allowed by the board itself.
Yes, Your Honor.
Putting people on probation, of giving them hearings before they were fired.
There is no evidence that the board gave hearings before they were fired. The evidence specifically indicates, for instance, that the other investigator, Tom Jennings, was not given a hearing when he was discharged. The issue of probation is entirely different than the issue of whether they were given notice of the charges and a hearing at the time of the discharge, which are actually the due process rights.
I see.
She's not claiming a right to probation, which there is no due process right to regardless.
So what the board was doing, in your view, is placing people on probation for a while as new employees before they made them, quote, what, permanent employees?
The board placed people on probation as new employees at times, and also at other times when work problems that they wanted to try to resolve may have come up. But the result of that was the board, when employees are under probation, was an administrative tool by which the board sort of provides closely monitored supervision.
But at the end of a probationary period for a new employee, you were then doing something with them. What was the board saying it was doing with them? What does the record show?
At the end of the probationary period, the employees no longer had to report or have meetings with a supervisor to discuss the work. The very close supervision or monitoring of the work ceased.
Did the board ever make the representation? Or did it ever follow the practice of informing employees at the end of a probationary period, they then had the right to their jobs except for dismissal for cause?
No.
The record doesn't show that.
The record does not show that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.